Hi Girish, welcome to the Big Unlock podcast. Really wonderful to have you here.
Hi Rohit, hi Ritu, thanks for having me here. It's a pleasure.
Welcome Dr. Girish. And you know, this is our seventh season and we have a lot of episodes, I think 175 and counting. So the listeners are always in for a treat and, you know, they always like to hear about new things about AI and, you know, all physicians have such different thoughts about AI and how you got here and what, you know, you think the future trends are. So looking forward to an engaging and interesting discussion and welcome once again.
Thank you.
I'm Rohit Mahajan. I'm the managing partner and CEO at Demo Consulting and Bigrio.
I'm Ritu M. Oberoi, currently based in Gurugram, India, also a managing partner here at Bigrio and Demo Consulting and co-host of the Big Unlock podcast with Rohit and looking forward to our discussions today. And we'd love to start with your introduction. Thank you.
Thanks, Ritu. Thanks, Rohit. My name is Girish Nadkarni. I am the chair of the Windreich Department of Artificial Intelligence at the Mount Sinai Health System. The department is the first of its kind in the country, which is established within a health system and a medical school. I'm also the director of the Hasso-Plattner Institute for Digital Health at Mount Sinai. And those are my .edu roles. But I also have a clinical and operational role within the health system as the chief AI officer for the health system. So I'm a clinician. I'm an internist, nephrologist, and I still actively see patients around 25% of my time in both in the outpatient setting as well as in the clinical wards on the clinical floors. But most of my time is sort of spent doing research, but also more importantly, translating, deploying, and scaling that research into clinical care and operations.
Awesome.
Yeah. So I grew up in India, in Bombay, which some of you might know is one of the biggest cities in India. I live in New York City right now, but Bombay, sometimes the scale of Bombay or Mumbai puts New York City to shame, just the number of people that you have, right? And I went to medical school in India. I was interested in tech and computer science from a young age. So as all of you know, both of you know, right, in India, you either go into engineering or medicine. That's how my parents put it to me, right? Either you're a doctor or an engineer or you're a failure and don't talk to us.
Don't show your face.
but jokes apart, right? Both of my parents were doctors. So even though I sort of cleared the engineering entrance exam, I was interested in medicine and particularly because it's, you know, when you get into it, it's a noble profession, right? I mean, what more noble profession is there than helping and healing people when they're their most vulnerable? And more importantly, in my mind, preventing them from getting to that A level of sickness, right? When I was in medical school in India, I was always interested in furthering my training in the United States because I think this United States sort of led the world in the forward thinking innovation around medicine as combined with tech. So I decided to come to the United States. I did a master's at Johns Hopkins Medical Institution. I did a couple of years of postdoctoral fellowship there. And since then, I've been in New York City from 2009, did my residency, my fellowship, my research and operational training, as well as my faculty positions, all at the Mount Sinai Health System. So the Mount Sinai Health System is sort of unique in the sense that there's a health system and then there's a school which sort of are jointly run together. And because of that, there is sort of a very free-flowing exchange between the academic side of things and the clinical and operational side of things, where things that are discovered in the academic arena get translated, deployed, and scaled across the system. But at the same time, there's a bi-directional exchange because being a physician and being involved in clinical and operational endeavors actually empowers you and inspires you to ask sort of basic research questions that help patients at scale. And that's why I'm very fortunate to be here. I honestly think that my role is interesting because, you know, healthcare is a field where change is obviously imposed from externally because of policies or tech, etc. But also change has to come from internally. And if clinicians, and I'm using the term in its broadest possible sense, physicians, but also nurses, other health specialties become true evangelists for sort of responsible tech that can actually make change in the healthcare arena like never before.
So that's a great introduction. Thank you so much, Girish. Really curious to know that, you know, currently with AI, obviously we're with this rapid change of pace, you know, with the LLMs and everything, we're hearing about a lot of physicians, clinicians getting into, you know, tech. But your interest in tech predated all of that. So tell us a little bit about that and how you felt at that time versus like now we know that people feel that it's so enabling. It's, you know, democratized access to tech and it's easy for non-tech people, especially clinicians and physicians, to really prototype and build out things which they might not have been able to do before. So do you feel the same way? Like, do you feel that there's been a lot of change, like a light year's worth of change there? Or
I was been in this field for the last 15 years, right? And obviously the interest in tech is for medicine's sake, right? Because tech is one way that you can scale impact, which you know a single physician or even a single healthcare system can't do, right? It can touch millions of lives at scale, which is what interests me in tech, right? Knowing medicine and taking the best out of clinical medicine, but then codifying it and coding it into a knowledge base that can scale across demographics, it can scale across populations, it can scale across countries, even globally, was what the promise of tech is. And yes, I mean, things have gotten easier in terms of building and prototyping because of large language models. Because if you think about what large language models are, right, they are encoded human knowledge at scale, right? So you have basically read all of human knowledge and have compressed it down into a space where you can be conversational with it and ask the right questions, et cetera, and get back knowledge at scale. So yes, it has democratized access because now a physician, suppose they have an interesting idea, they don't need to rely on a whole process in order to prototype their idea, right? They can prototype it and you can sort of bring your idea to life as an app or as a product, and then you can see how it works. But that also introduces some unique challenges, right? So let me just start off with a few assumptions, which I hope you all agree on, is that healthcare is probably one of the industries where trust, you know, trust between a provider and a patient, trust between the system and the larger system in which it works, be it social, cultural, people, is paramount, right? And so I think that we should do everything that we can to safeguard that trust. And the second thing is that scale is very, very useful, but that's also a flip side to that equation, right? If goodness can scale, badness can scale as well. If useful, effective product can scale, then mistakes or bias in that product can scale as well, right? And that's why it's important to be rigorous, responsible, and trustworthy in healthcare, especially because this is such a press-sensitive, patient-centric industry that you don't want a scaling of mistakes or bias. So I think that, you know, prototyping and scaling makes sense, but has to be backed by rigor, has to be backed by good governance, has to be backed by evidence.
Great. That's what we've been hearing across the board, that, you know, it comes with its own baggage and, you know, you have to be really careful to, like you said, have the rigor and the, you know, responsibility and the trust, which is paramount. So great answer. Thank you. Rohit, would you like to ask a question?
Yeah, Girish. So could you tell us a little bit more about some of the AI journey or any examples that you have seen on the way which have impacted patients in a positive way or which you think we could talk about today?
Oh, absolutely. So, I mean, I can talk about sort of the broader AI landscape in healthcare right now. So I think healthcare is at a transition point because there are the healthcare system in the US costs a lot of money and is focused predominantly on sick care rather than healthcare, right? We wait for people to get sick and then we treat the sickness. And you know, the financial incentives are also aligned in that direction. So those need to change. But I think what the promise of AI is, it's an arbitrage of knowledge for time. And what do I mean by that, right? I mean that because you have this compressed, encoded knowledge, you can use that to buy time for things, to make decisions. And a great example in healthcare is ambient scribes, right? Mm-hmm. So I can say this as a physician, right? Suppose I have a 20-minute patient visit, right? So the way the patient visit goes is I talk to the patient, you know, I examine them and I try to figure out what's wrong with them and how to try to help them get better. Mm-hmm. That all happens in like 10 minutes. And the next 10 minutes I spend typing my note. Mm-hmm. Or the other option is if I spend 20 minutes with the patient, then I have to go home and like after putting my kids to bed, I have to type that note in, right? But AI scribes sort of, or ambient AI sort of flip that paradigm on their head, right? Because now when you are having a conversation, a natural language, clinical conversation with a patient, you don't have to type in anything into the computer, right? You basically, it all gets transcribed and into a perfect note, and you just have to review that note for accuracy and sign off. And what would have taken you 10 minutes per patient would now take you 30 seconds. That's what I mean by an arbitrage of knowledge for time, because you have the AI engine to transcribe and understand this conversation and convert it into a document that the electronic health record requires. You are now gotten 10 minutes back per patient, which adds up, right? And more importantly, you don't have to spend time at home to do this. But you can also think about this arbitrage of knowledge and time another way, right? If you knew a patient was going to get sick in the hospital, you know, an hour before or 2 hours before they actually got sick, then you have enough time to make some life-changing intervention that actually prevents that patient from getting sick, right? So I think that the other way that AI helps arbitrage knowledge for time is moving care from reactive to proactive, from actually fixing the problem after it happened to preventing the problem from happening in the first place, right? So an example of that is we developed a model for deterioration, and it tells us that the patient is going to get sick like an hour before. So you can actually get the right people to look at that patient, see if there's preventable things that you can fix. Maybe the patient needs a little more IV fluids. Maybe the patient needs a different antibiotic or something of that sort. And that model is in production right now. There's another example which is sort of very close to my heart is the neonatal intensive care unit. That place in the hospital where the premature babies are usually kept. And these babies are probably the sickest in the hospital, right? I mean, anyone who has a kid remembers when small kids are this. And you can use vision AI or video AI, similar technology to what's used in self-driving cars, to monitor these kids over time and tell you an hour before if they are going to get sick. And actually, you can prevent that. So you can have a system in place in order to proactively track these kids' health over time and in the ICU and tell you when they're going to get sick so that you can intervene. So again, as I like to say, AI in healthcare is an arbitrage of knowledge for time, because you have time to make critically important decisions, but it also gives you providers time back in that day that would have been spent on like data entry and processing tasks.
That's true.
Amazing. This neonatal ICU example is just amazing. I mean, I can just imagine how many babies' lives have been impacted for good. That's a wonderful story. Thank you for sharing, Girish.
So, Girish, I think perhaps we were talking the other day as well about traditional AI and the new AI, right? The one which is to do with generative AI and large language models. So, how do you distinguish between the two at your facility or in your team? Like, how do you build a team? Because these AI tasks, they are cross-functional teams. You need the problem to be solved, then you need to build the solution. So you need technical people and you need domain experts. So how do you go about building that expertise and that team in your environment?
That's a big question, right? But I'll just try to answer it by part. So AI has been used in medicine for a while now, but most of it has been predictive AI, right? It's typically been like, given this set of data, what is the probability that something bad or good will happen to the patient in the next X amount of time, right? The difference between that versus generative AI is predictive AI is usually deterministic. By that, I mean that if you enter the same set of features, you're going to get the same answer. And it's very repeatable. New AI, just because it's much more flexible and much more non-deterministic, you can get different answers to the same question you ask, depending upon the day of the week, et cetera, et cetera. So it's like almost the left and the right side of the brain, right? One is extremely logical, follows a process and gets to the answer using that process. The other is more creative and it's basically
non-linear.
Linear, right? I think that they have to be governed slightly differently. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the way you evaluate each of them is slightly different, right? One, the more predictive AI you evaluate for prevent making sure that it's not biased against certain populations, that there is, when you deploy it and monitor it over time, there's no drift. That basically means because the underlying data has changed, the predictive model has changed, right? The other has to be a more holistic evaluation in which, you know, it may make sure that it aligns to both a broader set of ethical and values, as well as set guardrails in place in order to make sure that it doesn't deviate from those values, right? We have us setting up what's called as an assurance lab to monitor both the predictive as well as the generative AI side of things in slightly different ways. But the underlying theme is the same, that we want all use of AI to be safe, we want it to be effective, we want it to be responsible, and we want it to be ethical. And for that, you need cross-functional teams, right? So if you think about the domains which are required, you need someone who understands the clinical problem, right? And that usually is a person of the team that's addressing the problem. It can be a doctor, it can be a nurse, it can be an MA, it can be an allied professional, et cetera, et cetera. But you need that domain knowledge. Then you need a person who understands how to build AI models at scale. And that usually is an MLOps engineer or what we call an AI ops engineer right now. You also need a research component to this, is because, you know, MLOps engineers and AI engineers usually adhere to certain guidelines. And sometimes you need people to like think beyond the box and think about a different solution that can be used, right? And then finally, you need sort of a layer of ethics and understanding the risks and making sure it's ethical and it's responsible, right? So we have set up a governance structure where we have sort of combined all digital and AI applications, and we have divided it by domain, right? So there's AI care domain, which focuses predominantly on clinical care. There's an AI operations domain, which focuses on back office operations, finance, regulatory, et cetera. There's an AI workforce domain, which focuses on applications regarding the workforce, right? Things to make them empowered and more productive. There's a research domain, and then there is a student's domain, right? And then all of this is underlined by the assurance lab, and all of this is underlined by what we call it, the REP, or the Risk, Ethics, and Policy Committee, to make sure that even if algorithm is pristine, sometimes it can be, the application of it can have issues, right? Like, for example, you can have an algorithm to predict which patients won't show up in clinic, right? But the problem with that is if you apply it wrong, you will cancel the appointments of the patients most in need, because the patients who don't show up in clinic have probably unmet social needs that can lead to them not showing up in clinic. And canceling that in just appointments is injustice, right? Because the right solution would be to help them with their social needs, right? Help them to get transportation to the clinic, help them to pay for something that they wouldn't be. So I think you need cross-functional teams, but you need multidimensional teams if you think about the clinical or the operational or the workforce problem to be solved. But you need it to run it through governance to make sure that it's safe, it's effective, it's responsible and ethical.
That's awesome to know. And while you look at these applications, do you have some sort of a lens, Girish, or some sort of a success metric, perhaps, or, you know, people call it return on investment. How do you go about choosing? I'm sure with so many physicians now becoming interested in the number of ideas coming to you, perhaps as the chief AI officer, increase from previously.
Yeah, so we have a process in which any person in the health system can submit an AI or a digital idea and a problem that they want solved, right? As opposed, which can potentially be amenable to be solved by an AI or digital application. I work closely with the Chief Digital Transformation Officer, Robbie Freeman, by our Chief Digital Officer, Lisa Stump, for this, right? And so first of all, we, as a health system and as a academic health system, we have a defined list of clinical and operational priorities for the next 12 to 24 months, right?
Yeah.
A part of this is aligning priorities, right? So some of these ideas will align with the overall strategic priorities, and they obviously get a much higher prioritization and time to execution as opposed to others. So that's one. The second thing is it needs to run through governance, like I have described, right? Because we want to make sure that it's safe, effective, ethical, and responsible, not just in development, but also in execution. The third thing is that for all of the priorities, we have had a ROI calculation, and it's more of a multidimensional ROI calculation, not just focusing on the financial impact, but focusing on the workforce impact, focusing on the patient experience impact. So it's more of a holistic 360 degree ROI. This. But we also want to make sure that we monitor these and track this over time in order to make sure that they're meeting predefined milestones, right? Like, for example, you know, if you have a project, say, around ambient AI, right? You want to make sure that it's meeting predefined milestones around provider satisfaction, right? How many providers are satisfied before, right? And, you know, these predefined milestones have certain KPIs or key performance indicators attached to them that either have to be met or a reason has to be given why they're not met, and remediation plan has to be in place. So in that way, we are ensuring that we are looking at ROI, not just from the lens of financial ROI, but it's more of a holistic evaluation, which takes into account both the employee experience, and I'm using employees in broader sense possible, also the patient experience, the patient-centered to start off.
And one tough problem I've seen before, you know, C-suite also struggles with it, is that where do you get the money from? So if you're focused on cost savings, there is some aspect of, okay, we are going to save costs, you're becoming more efficient, you know, that's another way of looking at it. So how do you go about, in a broader question, let me put it, is that how do you have kind of like a budget allocated for the next, is it longer term or is it shorter term? Or any high level answer that you can provide?
But I mean, again, if you align your roadmap, for lack of a better word, the operation map with the larger strategic priorities, then automatically you get like C-suite buy-in, right? Because these are the strategic priorities that have been set by the C-suite. So we are just enablers and accelerator of those priorities, right? So it also becomes easier because then there have been budgets allocated for the strategic priorities. And to be honest, right, the cost of generating software has gone down, and you know much more about this than me.
Sure.
Because of coding agents and coding, right? So once that happens, I think if incentives and strategic priorities and then on a larger scale vision aligns, then the lower scale items start to align as well, right?
Of course. That's great to know.
So Girish, you mentioned ambient a couple of times, and you know we all know that that's been one of the big success stories with a lot of hospitals and health systems. So many times our listeners really like to hear, you know, what's coming next straight from the horse's mouth, as it was. So in terms of trends, or what do you think, you know, the next big win for AI is going to be? Where do you think it's headed? Maybe in the next 6 to 12 months, if you're thinking. What's going to be the next?
Well, I think there'll be much more multimodal integrations out there, which I think is particularly relevant in medicine, right? For example, right now it's predominantly text. That's not the way clinical decisions get made, right? Clinical decisions get made by talking to the patient, observing them, observing how they look, observing how they're talking to you, observing their frame of mind at that point of time. The technology is not quite there yet, but I think it will be there in the next few years. I don't want to make a prediction of how many. And I think that I still believe that it's in the short term, which means the next 10 years, it's about being augmentation rather than replacement. Yes. Because again, these systems, while powerful, are fragile, and trust is an important factor. And I don't think people are ready to move to a completely autonomous AI
dot. Yeah.
So I think that, you know, multimodal integration, text, voice, images is going to become more and more. So I think there will be a push towards, you know, not just ambient recording, but maybe with appropriate patient consent, video recording, you know, sensors, et cetera, et cetera. But I think broadly, the shift is going to be more towards proactive medicine rather than reactive medicine. And I think AI in all of its different iterations is just an enabler of that.
Great. We've been hearing a lot about voice agents and, you know, conversational voice as well. So I think you hit the nail on the head there. Thank you.
Thank you.
So Girish, now as we are ending, coming towards the close of the podcast, any other thoughts that you would like to share with the listeners?
Yeah.
Or any other comments?
Closing, like, AI is a very impressive technology. Mm-hmm. And for the first time in humankind, it's approaching cognition, right? Which was the whole preserve of humans' interest. I think we should think about AI as a collaborator, not as a replacement, which helps you become the best version of yourself that you want to be, while not being blinkers on saying that this is the best thing in the world, it has no flaws. You should have an honest assessment and monitoring of flaws, right? So I think that there's hope, but I think and there's hype, but it should always be tempered by reality and rigor.
Great. That's a great closing thought. Thank you so much, Girish. We really appreciate it. And
I'm Rohit Ritu. Great to get to know you.
Thank you for being our guest on the show. Thank you, Girish.
Thanks.